cheating on her because it fits the profile of a man who'd have reason to kill his wife. Like the insurance policy he claims he knew nothing about. Let's say he was cheating on her, Tracy said. What if the person he was cheating with was Devin Chambers? It gives him a motivation to kill Chambers. It gives Andrea a motivation to kill her also, Ken said. If Andrea's still alive, and I'm thinking she is, somebody moved that money. He pulled out of the parking space. Let's get something to eat. Maybe food will help us think through this. I know a place, Tracy said. My academy class used to go there. She directed him to the Tin Room Bar on Southwest 152nd Street in downtown Burien. A tin shop when the street had been lined with industrial businesses, the building was bought by a local entrepreneur who turned half of it into a movie theater and the other half into an eclectic bar and restaurant. The tools from the tin shop were mounted on the walls and the workbenches cut into tables. The renovation had started a revival on the street, which now included half a dozen other restaurants and bars. Tracy and Kins took a table beneath an impressionist painting of Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones frontman. She ordered the fish tacos and an iced tea. Kins ordered a hamburger and Diet Coke. Modern Love, one of the late, great David Bowie's best-known songs, filtered down from the overhead speakers, and several men and women sat at the bar watching a Mariners game on the flat-screen televisions. "We've come full circle, haven't we?" Kins said. "We're looking at three options. Either Strickland did kill his wife and staged it to look like an accident. She died on the mountain, and it was an accident. Or she outsmarted him, walked off the mountain, and tried to frame him for her murder, and is still alive." "Let's start with the first scenario," Tracy said. She sipped iced tea, set it aside, and used a paper napkin and a pen to diagram her thoughts. On the brink of financial disaster, he pushes his wife off the mountain, thinking he'll recover the insurance money and get access to the trust money she's been keeping from him. But the Pierce County DA names him a person of interest. The insurance company won't pay the life insurance benefits, and the wife's money disappears. In that scenario, the obvious person who took the trust money is Devin Chambers, right?
That would appear to be the case. She paid cash to have her face reconstructed and took over Strickland's alias.
Okay. So in that scenario, the husband hires the skip tracer, Tracy said. The skip tracer finds Devin Chambers. The husband hunts her down, kills her, and drains the bank account.
So far, I agree, Kin said.
Scenario two, Tracy said. He's intending to kill Andrea, or maybe he isn't, but in any event, she somehow dies in an accident.
My opinion is that's the most unlikely of the three scenarios, but just for argument's sake, everything else would remain the same, Ken said.
Agreed, Tracy said. So that leaves scenario three.
She outsmarted him. She figured out he was going to kill her on the mountain, staged her own death, walked off the mountain, took her trust, and is still alive somewhere, Ken said.
So when does the husband realize he's been set up? When he wakes up the next morning in the tent? Kin said. Maybe, but probably more likely when Fields comes knocking on his door, asking about insurance policies he's the supposed beneficiary of but knows nothing about, and telling him his wife was meeting with a divorce attorney and making allegations he was cheating on her again. The waitress returned with Tracy's tacos and Kin's burger. Tracy slid the napkin to the side to make room. Kins grabbed the bottle of ketchup and doctored his hamburger.
"So now he's got bigger problems," Kins said, pounding the bottom of the bottle. "The investigation prevents the insurance payout, and Andrea's separate trust fund is gone, along with his girlfriend. But the creditors are still knocking on the door, and he stands to lose everything."
"And he's wondering if the disappearance of the money and Chambers's disappearance are related," Tracy said, stealing one of Kins's French fries. So he uses a guerrilla email account to track Chambers down.
The skip tracer said the client initially asked to look for a Lynn Hoff, Kins said. How would the husband have known about Lynn Hoff?
Maybe Devin Chambers, Tracy said, if she and Graham Strickland were initially working together.
And if they weren't? Then I don't know. Maybe he found something around the house that tipped him off. Kins bit into his burger and wiped his hands on the cloth napkin in his lap.
You think Andrea could have confided in Devin Chambers?
It's possible. The boss said they were close, maybe Andrea's only friend.
So when she finds out her best friend is sleeping with her husband, why doesn't she just take off? Why go up the mountain at all?
Two reasons I can think of. One, she'd confided in Devin about Lynn Hoff, so Devin would know how to track her and the money. Kins dipped a French fry in ketchup and ate it.
All right. What's the second reason?
The counselor I spoke with said it's possible the years of abuse resulted in a dissociative disorder, and that Andrea could become volatile if she were to suffer some acute trauma, or if she felt abandoned or desperate.
Like finding out your only friend is sleeping with your husband and is trying to rip off your life savings? Kins said.
So simply fleeing was not going to keep someone from pursuing her, nor was it going to allow her to get even with either of them.
So you're saying, in this scenario, Andrea Strickland had to make it look like the husband killed her on that mountain and that Chambers was in on it, Kins said, taking another bite.
She takes out the insurance policy, consults the divorce attorney, and drops hints that the husband is cheating on her again, Tracy said. Then she uses the skip tracer to track down Devin Chambers. Chambers disappears, and everyone thinks it's the husband.
Why was Devin Chambers on the run?
Chance to start a new life with $500,000 in cash, Tracy said.
Maybe, Kins said. But don't you think it's more likely the husband killed Chambers, but Andrea Strickland moved the money before he could get to it?
I don't know.
I think she's still alive, Kins said.
We need to find the skip tracer. Maybe there's some way to determine from where those emails originated. Maybe if we can narrow it to a city, we can determine whether it was the husband or whether it was her.
Kins put down the hamburger and continued munching his French fries. I thought you said those emails were anonymous.
Nothing is completely anonymous.
You remember that Harvard student who got busted for calling in a bomb scare to get out of taking finals?
Vaguely. I looked it up the other night. He used a guerrilla email account and an anonymous server, but the FBI determined that he'd logged onto Harvard's Wi-Fi server. We don't have to link the emails to a particular computer. It might be enough if we can show they came from someplace like a Portland Starbucks near Graham Strickland's house, or some other place where she's in hiding. Tracy tapped the two manila folders from ALS. But the first thing we have to do is take this to Nolasco and Martinez, and tell them the body in the pot is not Andrea Strickland. That means Pierce County has no basis to assert jurisdiction because there is no longer a connection between our murder and their, once again, missing person investigation.
Chapter 26. Tracy and Kins met with Dull and Foz over the weekend to discuss the DNA results and how best to present the information to Nolasco and Martinez. All agreed that, given the volatility of Tracy's relationship with Nolasco, it would be best if Kins took the lead explaining the DNA results and the potential ramifications. None of them believed for a minute Nolasco or Martinez would not see through the ploy, but they hoped two factors would at least make them look past it. Tracy had hinted at the first factor in her earlier meeting with Nolasco. The case was continuing to generate publicity. Most recently, the national news media had picked up the story, and it was a certainty that media coverage would only intensify when news broke that the woman in the pot was not Andrea Strickland, but her best friend Devin Chambers. Second, Nolasco and Martinez would not be able to deny Tracy's reasoning that Pierce County no longer had a basis to assert jurisdiction. The four of them asked for a meeting with Nolasco and Martinez Monday afternoon and walked, en masse, into the conference room. Nolasco and Martinez joined them minutes later, confirming that the two men had met prior to the requested meeting, probably to speculate on its purpose. Nolasco and Martinez continued to the far side of the table and settled into chairs. Rather than the four detectives all sitting together on the same side of the table, like rival gangs drawing a line in the sand, Dell sat at the head of the table,
Tracy at the far end, and Faz and Kins directly across from their superiors. Nolasco seemed mildly surprised when Kins, not Tracy, handed each of them a copy of the first report from ALS and explained how that report came to exist. Nolasco slid on cheaters, alternately considering the report and looking over the top of his glasses as Kins spoke. Martinez remained hunched over the report, his meaty forearms pressed to the table. During one of our end-of-the-day meetings, Tracy was going over what she'd learned talking with Penny Orr, Andrea Strickland's aunt, Kins said. The aunt said Andrea was withdrawn and prone to anxiety, that she bit her fingernails until, at times, they bled. That made me think about the autopsy photographs, Faz said, just as they'd rehearsed, though it didn't sound that way. One in particular, the one of the victim's hand, jumped out at me. She was wearing blue nail polish.
You thought of this? Nolasco said.
Yeah, Faz said, sounding slightly indignant and doing a good job of making it seem authentic. I was thinking maybe if she'd put the polish on recently, it might be evident she had a date and was concerned about her appearance, that maybe she knew her killer. But when Tracy mentioned what the aunt said, I said, holy shit, and pulled up the photograph.
Funk confirmed the nails are real, Kins said.
That got us all thinking that the body in the crab pot might not be Andrea Strickland.
He directed his final comment to Martinez, who'd remained silent and maintained a poker face.
Why wasn't this revelation in the report provided to Pierce County? Nolasco said.
For the reasons I'm about to explain. Kins picked up a stapled document from the Manila file. What you have before you is a DNA profile of Penny Orr, Andrea Strickland's aunt. The lab compared that profile with the DNA profile the crime lab developed for the woman in the crab pot. There's a 99.95% probability that the two women are not related. Martinez looked up from the report.
It isn't Strickland?
It is not, Kins said.
So you were wrong, Nolasco said, directing his comment to Tracy.
No, Kins said. We were right. The woman in the crab pot used the name Lynn Hoff to obtain facial reconstruction surgery. Lynn Hoff is the alias Andrea Strickland used when she went into hiding. It's her picture on the driver's license.
Then how can it not be her in the pot? Nolasco asked.
I'm going to explain that now, Kins said. He handed the second report across the table. This is the DNA profile of a woman named Allison McCabe.
Who's she? Nolasco asked.
She's the sister of Devin Chambers. Devin Chambers was Andrea Strickland's best friend.
It's Devin Chambers, Martinez said.
He'd flipped to the last page quickly to read the conclusion in the report.
How the hell did she end up in the crab pot?
That's what we hope to find out, sir.
What do you mean you hope to find out? Nolasco said, his gaze shifting between the four of them.
Martinez raised a hand and sat back from the table, looking at them like a bemused grandfather considering his grandchildren. Those in the department knew Martinez to be a cop first and a bureaucrat second. The fact that he insisted on wearing the uniform every day reflected how he perceived and projected himself. Tracy was banking on that perception now, banking on Martinez understanding that every good cop wanted to clear his or her cases, not to pad personal statistics. They owed it to the families of the victims.
What your detectives mean, Captain, is if the woman in the crab pot is not Andrea Strickland, then Pierce County does not have jurisdiction, because the woman who went missing in their county is not the woman in the crab pot, Martinez said. Therefore, they have no basis to assert a continuing investigation. Am I right, Detective Crosswhite?
I believe you are, sir, Tracy said.
Detective Rowe?
Makes sense to me.
Perhaps you can explain how you obtained the DNA profiles of these two individuals, Nolasco said, holding up both documents, when you no longer had jurisdiction.
Martinez again raised his hand.
I'm suspecting your detectives forwarded DNA kits to the individuals, and then there was a time lag between when they were sent and when they were obtained for analysis. Am I right? You are, Kin said.
You want this case? Martinez said, now shifting his gaze between the four of them.
It's our case, Tracy said.
You understand the ramifications, that this will become an even higher profile investigation when we advise the media that the body is not Andrea Strickland.
We do, Kin said.
Which is going to mean greater pressure that we get this done.
Understood, Kin said.
Good, because when we go to bat for you and get this case back, I'm going to expect it.
Martinez turned to Nolasco.
Captain, your detectives want this case.
Let's make it happen.
Tracy followed the three other members of her team out of the conference room and back to their bullpen. They refrained from high fives or chest bumps. To the contrary, Foz, Kins, and Dell all looked as though they'd just walked through a minefield but somehow managed not to take a wrong step. Their good fortune more to do with blind luck than skill. Now they had to wait. They couldn't work on the investigation until, and if, they officially got the case back from Pierce County. But they all agreed they had a moral obligation to advise Penny Orr that the woman in the crab pot was not her niece, and to tell Allison McCabe the more difficult news, that her sister was dead. The first news could be delivered over the phone. The second could not.
No one should hear that over the phone, Tracy said, remembering the call from the King County Medical Examiner's office, advising her that two hunters had stumbled across human remains in the hills above her hometown of Cedar Grove.
I'll get my uncle to make a drive back out there and tell her in person, Fa said. God knows he's done it enough times before.
Tracy would call Penny Orr. Let's reconvene in an hour and go over what we're going to need and want going forward.
Penny Orr's reaction to the news that her niece was not the woman in the pot had been subdued. Tracy couldn't blame her. She'd now grieved, potentially unnecessarily, twice, and Tracy could not tell Orr with any conviction that Andrea was or was not still alive. She ended the conversation with a promise that the next time they spoke, she would have a better answer for Orr. That afternoon, the A-team reconvened at the table in the center of their bullpen with their list of things to do. They needed to have the skip tracer's computer analyzed. If they could determine the location of the sender of the guerrilla emails, they might be able to conclude whether it had been Graham Strickland, Andrea Strickland, or possibly, though not likely, an altogether different person. They decided to use the FBI to perform a forensic analysis of the skip tracer's computer, and Tracy tasked Foz with bird-dogging it. Foz and Dell would also have to re-canvass the buildings and marinas, this time with a photograph of Devin Chambers. Run the photograph by Dr. Wu while you're at it. Confirm Chambers was his patient, Tracy said to Foz. Tracy and Kins would work with Pierce County, who, according to Fields, had subpoenaed Graham Strickland's cell phone and credit card records, as well as his bank statements. They'd look for evidence tying him to Devin Chambers. The fraud unit would continue working to track the location of the trust funds.
We should also get a search warrant for the husband's home, Kin said. I have a contact at Portland PD, Jonathan Zhu. Good guy. We worked a case up here last year. He can help facilitate getting a search warrant with a local judge. When do you want to talk to the husband?
I'll call Zhu and coordinate so we can do both at the same time.
Let's wait at least until we get his credit card records back from Pierce County, Tracy said.
Unlikely we'll get another shot.
What do we do about Andrea Strickland? Foz asked.
Tracy gave his question some thought. They'd already mistakenly sent out her picture to all the news services and local and national law enforcement. At present, she remained dead, and Tracy hoped to talk to Graham Strickland without him knowing otherwise. Let's leave that alone for now.
Late in the afternoon, Nolasco appeared in their cubicle. He had removed his tie and rolled up the cuffs of his shirt sleeves.
You got jurisdiction, he said. Pierce County is transferring the file back up here.
They put up much of a squawk? Dell asked.
That'd be putting it mildly.
Nolasco looked to Foz.
They wanted to know how you got the DNA profiles,
And don't think for a minute I believed that crap about you remembering an autopsy photo, Fazio.
You underestimate me, Captain, Faz said.
Yeah.
Nolasco turned his attention to Tracy.
And I'm not buying that bullshit that you got out the DNA kits before we lost jurisdiction, but I'm being told to leave it be, so I'm going to leave it be. But let me be very clear about this. You screw this up, and the hammer is going to fall hard on all four of you. It's like Martinez said. You wanted this case. You got it. So get it done.
Nolasco left the bullpen, stopped, and turned back.
One other thing. You're to keep Pierce County fully informed of every development.
What? Tracy said, not relishing the thought of sharing any information with Stan Fields.
Why?
Because that's the agreement reached, Nolasco said. You provide them with copies of your reports, witness interviews, and anything that has to do with Andrea Strickland. I'm assuming that's not going to be a problem?
Nobody spoke.
Good.
Nolasco departed.
Hey, it's a victory, Faz said. Let's not let him make it feel hollow.
Bennett Lee called Tracy shortly after Nolasco departed their bullpen. Lee wanted to read her a media statement SPD intended to make at an afternoon news conference. He said he'd keep it simple. He'd state that, after DNA analysis, it had been determined that the woman in the crab pot was not Andrea Strickland, the Portland resident believed to have disappeared on Mount Rainier. Tracy asked him why he had to say anything, and Lee told her the brass could not bury the fact that the victim was not Strickland. Lee agreed not to disclose the identity of the woman in the pot, pending notification of next of kin. That meant Tracy would have to expedite any interview of Graham Strickland. Lee would further advise the media that since the body had been found in Seattle, the Pierce County Sheriff's Office had voluntarily agreed to relinquish jurisdiction and return the investigation to the Seattle Police Department, but that both agencies would continue to cooperate with each other.
Voluntarily agreed to relinquish jurisdiction? Tracy said. Did you come up with that language?
That's how they want to spin it, Lee said. I have a news conference at 5 if you're interested.
When Tracy walked into her kitchen at the end of the day, Dan greeted her with a kiss. He'd formed hamburger patties and was in the process of making a salad. Rex and Sherlock gave her a perfunctory greeting but quickly returned to Dan's side, noses lifted to the counter, and eyes glued to the plate of beef.
"When it comes to raw meat, we're a couple of Brussels sprouts," Dan said. "You made good time."
"One of the few advantages of working late. No traffic.
We got the crab pot case back."
"Saw it on the news." Dan carried the plate of hamburger patties out to the barbecue on the deck.
"Van Pelt didn't pull any punches."
"That's why we all love her." As word leaked that the woman in the crab pot was not Andrea Strickland, speculation rose in the media about the identity of the woman and what it meant. Was Andrea Strickland alive? Dead on the mountain? Dead someplace else? It had led to a packed news conference and made Bennett Lee's press conference the lead on the local evening news, which the four detectives had watched together in the B-team's bullpen, along with half a dozen other detectives from their section, and the burglary section down the hall. Dan picked up the plate of patties.
"Should I put these on, or do you want a chance to unwind?"
"No, let's eat. I'm starving."
"You want a hamburger bun with yours?"
"I better not," she said, following him and the dogs out onto the deck. "If I'm going to fit into anything resembling a wedding dress, I better go easy on the carbs."
"You given that much thought?"
Dan placed the burgers on the already warm grill. They sizzled and sparked a small flame.
"I thought I'd surprise you."
Dan nodded, spatula in hand, but she knew him well enough to know he had something else on his mind.
"You don't want to be surprised?" she asked.
"No, it's all good. You want cheese on yours?"
"You know, if we're going to get married, we're both going to need to do a better job of being honest with each other."
He gave her a soft smile.
"I think you should wear a wedding dress."
It had been the last thing she expected him to say, and she stumbled to respond.
"You mean an actual wedding dress with a veil and train and..."
push-up bustier?
Definitely the push-up bustier, he said, closing the lid on the grill. Smoke seeped out the back. And I think you should ask Kins to give you away. She chuckled softly at the thought of it, then realized Dan was serious.
Are you talking about a traditional wedding, Dan O'Leary?
I am.
You do realize we've both been married already.
Yes, but you never got your wedding. Dan turned from the barbecue and looked at her with a serious gaze. Tracy had told him she and Ben became engaged the same night Sarah disappeared, but that she'd never had the opportunity to plan the wedding she'd envisioned. Instead, and more because she was afraid of losing him, Tracy and Ben got married in a civil ceremony at the courthouse, just the two of them. Two court clerks had served as witnesses. The decision had been a mistake. Her thoughts and actions had remained focused on finding out what had happened to Sarah, and when she could not move on, Ben had. The divorce papers had come in the mail. Astonished and moved that Dan had remembered, she wasn't sure what to say.
I don't need anything extravagant, Dan.
It's not about what you need. It's about what you deserve. She struggled again to find the right words. She wanted a traditional wedding. She'd always envisioned a traditional wedding. She just never thought it possible. And you deserve the wedding you envisioned, Dan continued. I know it was a bad time, and I know you'll never say you were disappointed your engagement and wedding got buried by Sarah's disappearance. But I also know there is a part of you that still thinks about what that day might have been like.
Things happen, she said softly. Dreams change.
She moved to him and wrapped her arms around his waist.
I'm happy I have the man of my dreams.
And I'm happy with the woman of my dreams, he said. But there's no reason you can't have the fairy tale wedding of your dreams, too. She took a deep breath.
You've really thought about this, haven't you?
He nodded. I really have. Look, I don't want to say I feel bad for you because I know how much you love to be pitied, but I do feel bad for you. I feel bad that you had to go through everything you've gone through. I feel bad that it all happened on the night you got engaged and that you never had the wedding of your dreams. His comment made her think again of Andrea Strickland and her horrible life, regardless of whether she was alive or deceased. Tracy knew, as much as anyone, there were no guarantees in life. Tomorrow was not a given. She kissed him.
Is that the reason for the lighthouse and the restaurant? The fairy tale?
He shrugged and smiled, close-lipped.
Because you are truly a prince.
Still masculine, though, right? Not the tights-wearing prince who sings and dances. She laughed.
Definitely still masculine.
Okay, she said. But if we're going for the full-blown fantasy, I do have a request. Fire away, Cinderella.
How much pull do you have with that Coast Guard commander?
You want to get married at the lighthouse?
Unless you have access to a castle.
I think it will be perfect, Dan said. And I just so happen to know that they do allow weddings. She chuckled.
You looked into it already.
Dan feigned ignorance. Like I said, you deserve the fairy tale wedding. She kissed him warmly, again, and could feel their bodies relaxing into each other.
Dan, she said.
Yeah?
Turn off the grill so the hamburgers don't burn.
I thought you were starving.
I am, but now I'm starving for something better than hamburger.
Chapter 27. The following morning, Tracy and Kins were once again traveling south on the I-5 freeway to Portland. They had worked late putting together a probable cause affidavit to search Strickland's Pearl District loft, where he had lived with Andrea and apparently remained. Kins had transmitted the affidavit to Detective Jonathan Zhu in Portland. After talking with Strickland, they would accompany Zhu to a local judge to get a warrant issued. They had no idea what they might find in the apartment, if anything, but stranger things had happened, and it was a stone neither felt comfortable leaving unturned.
Kins had also asked Zhu to run Devon Chambers through Portland's system. Zhu sent back an email with attachments, and Tracy reviewed them on the 3-hour drive south. She had 2 prior arrests in New Jersey in her early 20s, one for check fraud and another for obtaining prescriptions from doctors under false pretenses. Both were expunged.
Sounds like her sister had her pegged, Kin said.
Chambers spent 30 days in a sober living house and had been required to attend AA meetings. Her compliance had expunged her file. Nothing in her bank statements or on her credit card or cell phone records indicated she'd recently come into money or that she was preparing to flee the country. In fact, she had no savings and very little in her checking account. It wouldn't come close to paying off her considerable credit card debt, all of which was also in accord with what her sister had described. This time, Tracy and Kins did not call ahead to ask Phil Montgomery's permission to speak to Strickland. Instead, Tracy called the law firm where Strickland now worked and posed as a potential client hoping to set up a meeting. Strickland's assistant advised that Strickland had interviews in the office all morning and a lunch meeting out of the office, but said he could meet with her at 3 p.m. Tracy said she'd get back to her and hung up. With cell phones, it was always possible Strickland could still call his lawyer, tell Tracy and Kins to go piss in a pool, and sit mute. Tracy sensed that would not be the case. She had the same feeling about Strickland that Stan Fields had shared. Strickland believed he was smarter than everybody, and he would think he could run circles around them. Tracy was counting on that arrogance. The law firm where Strickland worked was in a converted 1-story house in a mixed residential and commercial neighborhood. Most of the buildings had bars on the windows and metal gates protecting the front doors.
"My, how the mighty have fallen," Kin said.
"Maybe not that far," Tracy pointed out Strickland's cherry red Porsche parked in the home's driveway.
"Why doesn't he just put a Steal Me sign on the windshield and be done with it?" Kin said.
Kins parked across the street in a spot where they could view the car. Though it remained warm, 88 degrees, the sky had begun to cloud over and to darken. A breeze rustled the leaves of the trees along the block.
"You and Dan made any plans for the wedding?" Kins asked, as they settled in to wait.
"We were talking about it last night. Dan wants a traditional wedding."
Kins made a face. "You mean like a priest and a church and all that pomp and circumstance?"
"Pretty much, though I've told him I want to get married at the Alki Point Lighthouse."
"Can you do that?"
"Apparently. That's where he proposed."
"Nice," Kin said. "You know that guy is making the rest of us look bad? Don't tell Shanna."
"Too late."
"Why? How did you propose?"
"My last college game. I walked to the stands where she was waiting, and instead of kissing her, I dropped to a knee."
"Please don't tell me you had the ring in your pants." "Football pants don't have pockets."
"I know."
Kins laughed. "No, her sister held it for me."
"So what's wrong with that?"
"I didn't think anything was wrong with it. Shanna thinks I did it because with 60,000 fans watching, she couldn't turn me down."
Tracy laughed. "Dan wants me to wear a wedding dress and have someone give me away."
Kins nodded, clearly thinking that statement through. "You given that any thought?"
"A little bit. I have a question to ask you."
"Fire away," Kins said, now smiling.
"Do you think Foz would do it?"
"Fuck you, Crosswhite," he laughed,
then suddenly sat up and started the car.
"There's our boy."
Strickland bounded down 2 wood steps in straight leg jeans and a fashionable long sleeve shirt with the cuffs rolled up and tail hanging out. He slid into the Porsche, fired up the engine with a roar, and peeled out of the driveway onto the street, as if in a hurry.
"Everything is for show with this guy, isn't it?" Kin said, following at a safe distance.
Strickland drove west, made a couple of turns, and crossed the Ross Island Bridge.
"You think he's heading home?" Tracy asked.
"Don't know. Right direction, though," Kin said.
"Receptionist said he had an appointment?"
"That's what she said." Strickland exited just after crossing the bridge. He took surface streets along the Willamette River, then quickly pulled to the curb. Kin slid behind a parked car. they watched Strickland exit the Porsche and walk toward the waterfront.
"I hope he's not another one of those people who likes to walk on their lunch hour," Ken said.
"Not in those shoes," Tracy said. Strickland disappeared beneath a brown awning and entered a restaurant called 3 Degrees.
"You hungry?" Tracy asked.
"I am now," Ken said, pushing out of the car. They ignored the maitre d', telling the young woman they were meeting someone for lunch, and found Strickland seated beneath an umbrella at a table on the patio. He had his head down, fingers moving rapidly across the keypad of his cell phone. Strickland looked up expectantly when Tracy pulled out the chair to his right. His smile quickly faded to confusion, then concern.
"What are you doing here?"
Strickland's gaze flicked between Kins and Tracy. His cheeks flushed. Tracy sat.
"We came to tell you good news, Mr. Strickland. Your wife is not the woman in the crab pot."
"I already know that," Strickland said. "It was all over the news, and my attorney called to let me know."
Kins shrugged at Tracy.
"Looks like we drove a long way for nothing."
"I would have thought the news would have made you happy," Tracy said.
"Not really," Strickland said. "She's still missing, isn't she?"
"Yeah, there's that," Kins said.
"I've already talked to you about this," Strickland said, dropping his gaze back to his cell phone.
"We're not here to talk about your wife," Tracy said, keeping her tone informal.
"We came to ask you a few questions about Devon Chambers." At the mention of the name, Strickland's fingers paused on the keypad.
"You do know her, don't you?" Tracy asked.
Thunder rumbled in the distance. Strickland raised his gaze.
"Of course I know her," he said, calm. "She was a friend of Andrea's."
"How close were they?" Tracy asked, deciding to play him for a bit. Strickland sat back and crossed his legs, leaving his phone on the table. The canvas of the umbrella rippled in the breeze, sounding like a sail catching the wind.
"I don't really know. She and Devon worked together."
"How much time did they spend together outside of work?"
"I really couldn't say for certain. Andrea didn't go out much after work. She was an introvert."
"How did she spend her time?"
"Reading. She read all the time."
"What was your relationship to Devon Chambers?" Tracy asked.
"I didn't have one," Strickland said, his demeanor still relaxed.
Lightning crackled, a blue-white fork in the distance. Seconds later came another clap of thunder. The waitress returned.
"Would you rather move inside?"
Strickland shook his head.
"This is fine," he said, almost as if he were playing a game of chicken with Tracy and Kins.
The waitress looked to the empty chair.
"Are we waiting for one more?"
"Yes," Strickland said.
After the waitress departed, Tracy said, "Did you have a romantic relationship with Devon Chambers?"
"What?"
Strickland made a face like it was a ridiculous question.
"No, of course not."
"Adultery isn't a crime, Mr. Strickland," Kins said.
"I'm aware of that, detective."
"Your wife told her boss you were having an affair."
"My wife did and said a lot of crazy things, including faking her own death. She wasn't exactly acting rationally."
It was a good argument. One that Strickland and his attorney would hit hard if they ever had to argue that his wife had set it up to look like Strickland had intended to kill her.
"So you weren't having an affair?" Tracy asked.
"I've already talked about this with the other detective," he said. "And as my attorney advised you the other day, we're not going back over old ground."
Another bolt of lightning sparked in the cloud layer just over the bridge.
"When's the last time you saw Devon Chambers?" Tracy asked.
This time, the thunder exploded overhead, strong enough to rattle the restaurant windows. Strickland shook his head as if he were completely disinterested.
"I don't know, months."
"You haven't seen her since your wife's disappearance?"
"No."
"You didn't seek her out to ask if she knew anything about it?"
"No, because as I've already explained, at the time I believed my wife had died in an accident. So what exactly was I going to ask Devon Chambers?"
"Whether or not she knew about the insurance policy your wife took out naming you a beneficiary?
or why your wife would have consulted a divorce lawyer or told her boss you were cheating on her again?" Kin said. "It was an incredibly stressful time for me, detectives. I believed my wife had died. Then I'm suddenly being questioned like I'm a suspect in her death."
"You did have an affair, though," Kin said. "You admitted that."
"It was a mistake, okay? I've been over this. I'd been seeing the person before I met Andrea. I should have ended it. I didn't. And, as you said, it isn't illegal."
The first drops of rain splattered the concrete patio and the canvas umbrella. Strickland acted like he didn't notice.
"Any idea where we might find Devon Chambers?" Tracy asked.
"I assume you would find her either at work or at her home." Tracy watched Strickland's face for any sign he knew Chambers had fled, but his expression remained completely placid, and his eyes never shifted from hers.
"Are you aware that Devon Chambers told her boss and some of the tenants in her apartment building that she was moving back home to New Jersey?"
"Obviously not," he said, "or I would have told you that in response to your last question."
He turned his head and looked to the interior of the restaurant, presumably searching for his lunch date. Water trickled over the sides of the umbrella. Kins had to move his chair closer to the table to keep from getting wet.
"She never told you that?" he said.
"I told you I haven't seen or spoken to Devon Chambers in months. We seem to be going in circles." Strickland uncrossed his legs and looked again to the lobby.
"This is the first you heard of it?" Tracy asked.
"Yes."
"Have you ever heard the name Lynn Hoff?" Kins asked.
"The first time I heard that name was when my attorney called and told me you found Andrea's body, and that she had been using that name."
"You'd never heard that name before?"
"No."
"Any idea how your wife obtained her fake identity?"
"None whatsoever. But then it appears my wife was full of surprises, doesn't it?"
"Did you hire a private investigator to look for Lynn Hoff?" Kins asked.
"Why would I hire a private investigator to look for someone I didn't know?"
"Because you thought someone named Lynn Hoff stole your wife's money," Kins said.
Strickland scoffed.
"Why would I have thought that?"
"Because your wife had close to $500,000 that appears to have just disappeared," Kins said. "Or didn't that concern you?"
"As I said, I had other concerns at the time, detective."
"So you didn't even try to find the money?"
Kins didn't bother to hide his skepticism.
"No, I didn't. Why? Have you found it?"
"And you have no idea who might have taken it?" Kins asked.
"None."
An Asian woman approached their table. At least 6 feet tall, she was all legs in tight-fitting blue jeans, high heels, and a sheer blouse that looked to be buttoned at her navel. She gave them an uncertain smile. Strickland quickly pushed back his chair, intercepting her.
"Would you give us a minute?"
He stepped away from the table, water dripping from the umbrella onto his back as he did, and guided the woman inside the restaurant, though not so far that Tracy could not see them.
"You think he'll bolt?"
Kins asked, watching Strickland.
"Could," Tracy said.
"He's lying."
"About something," Tracy agreed. "About what, I don't know yet."
After a minute, the woman departed. Strickland rejoined them, ducking beneath the dripping umbrella. He sat back, sipping a glass of water.
"We don't care who you were sleeping with, Mr. Strickland," Kins said. "That's none of our business."
"What is your business here?"
"Finding Devon Chambers," Tracy said.
"Did something happen to Devon Chambers?" he asked.
"I thought you said she left the state."
"That's what she told people," Tracy said. "According to a sister, that's not the case."
"And you think I had something to do with her disappearance?"
"Do you know if Devon Chambers and your wife ever discussed your personal affairs?" Tracy asked.
"I can't imagine what they discussed."
"Do you know if Devon Chambers was aware of your wife's money?"
"I doubt it. I didn't even know about it."
"When did you find out?"
"Andrea mentioned it when we went to obtain a bank loan for the new business."
Did you ask your wife why she hadn't told you before then? Tracy asked.
Of course.
What did she say?
She said her parents left it for her in trust, and she'd only recently gained control of the money.
Did you ask her to use the money?
No.
No? Kin said.
No,
Strickland said, shaking his head. She said the money couldn't be used to start a business, and I respected that.
It didn't upset you? Kin said.
Strickland shrugged.
Maybe a little at first, but we discussed it and I understood where she was coming from.
And you have no idea what happened to your wife's money? Kins asked, clearly pushing Strickland.
I've told you no. If she's still alive, I presume she has it wherever she is. If she's not, then someone stole it.
May I ask you a question, detectives?
Sure, Tracy said.
Have you made any progress on identifying the woman in the crab pot?
We're working on it, Tracy said.
The old adage, when it rains, it pours, proved accurate. The summer storm did not blow through. It brought a steady rain and a drop in the temperature. With no umbrellas, Tracy and Kins made a mad dash to the car, but were still dripping wet by the time they climbed inside.
He's a piece of work, isn't he?
Kin started the car and turned on the heater. Tracy diverted the vents, which were spewing cold air.
If he did kill them, he won't be easy to convict. Both murders were well thought out. We got lucky when Shill got tangled with the crab pot.
Tracy checked her watch. What time are we meeting your Portland detective?
3, Kin said. Let me call him and see if we're still on schedule or if he can move it up a bit.
I'll call Foz.
Foz advised Tracy that he'd spoken to the FBI about the status of their forensic examination of the Skip Tracer's computer. So far, it appeared the Skip Tracer's client had logged on to a server in a public location, and the FBI was optimistic they'd at least be able to narrow that location.
Dell and I are about to go out to the apartments in Marina's with Chambers's photograph. We'll also stop by Dr. Wu's.
Kinz's conversation with the Portland detective was considerably shorter. When he hung up, he swore.
Is nothing in this case simple?
What happened? Tracy asked, disconnecting her call with Foz.
They got a shooting over at one of the college campuses. My guy's out the rest of the day.
Can someone else handle the warrant?
Kinz shook his head.
You know how it is. The earliest he can do it is tomorrow morning.
The strain of long days and interrupted sleep had caught up to Tracy. Her clothing was wet and uncomfortable, and she felt frustrated.
Well, no sense driving back to Seattle just to turn around and come back down, she said. I guess we're going to have to get a hotel.
I just love wearing day-old underwear, Kin said.
They ate lunch and checked into adjacent rooms in a Marriott courtyard at the end of the waterfront. Tracy made some phone calls and answered emails while watching the storm out her hotel window, the sky now a roiling sea of angry dark clouds and the rain coming in sheets. She checked in with Dan and told him she would not be home, then called in to the office. Foz and Dell had returned to police headquarters after canvassing the marinas and the apartments with a photograph of Devin Chambers.
"Nobody recalls seeing her," Foz said. Only positive identification was by Dr. Wu, which didn't exactly come as a surprise.
Did your uncle talk to Chambers's sister?
He got to her this afternoon. He said it went okay as far as those things go. Said the sister took it stoically and thanked him.
Any parents? Tracy asked.
Deceased.
Any other siblings?
Apparently not. What did the hubby have to say? Foz asked.
He don't know nothing from nothing, she said, using a Foz colloquialism.
Did you get the search warrant?
No, they got a homicide over at one of the colleges, so Kinz's guy is out until tomorrow morning. Someone knocked on her door. The clock on the nightstand read 5:30. She and Kinz had agreed to meet at 6.
Somebody's at the door. I'll call you later, she said to Foz, and hung up.
Kinz stood in the hallway looking frustrated.
We're not going to get our warrant, he said.
Chapter 28. The jurisdiction cluster had become a whole lot more entangled. Portland police were exercising control over Strickland's Pearl District loft, and rightfully so. It was now a crime scene, an apparent homicide. A large contingent of police and emergency vehicles, fire department response units, blue and white patrol cars, unmarked police vehicles, a CSI van, and the Portland Medical Examiner's van cluttered the street in front of the three-story brick building. As was always the case, this much excitement was just too much for the local population to ignore. With the storm having passed and the sun again beaming, a crowd had gathered behind sawhorses that closed street access. Uniformed officers directed traffic to detours. Kin slowed as he approached and lowered his window, showing the officer his badge.
"Seattle?" the officer asked.
"We have an interest in another case up north."
"Wherever you can find a place to park."
The officer moved one of the sawhorses so Kin's could drive through. Kins parked behind an unmarked Ford in the middle of the narrow street. Around them stood three- and four-story brick buildings that looked to have been originally built for industrial purposes, then renovated, earthquake-proofed, and no doubt inspected ad nauseam for compliance with building codes before being turned into mixed-use structures. The area reminded Tracy of Pioneer Square in Seattle. After an urban renewal in the 1960s, Pioneer Square had become home to art galleries, internet companies, cafes, sports bars, and nightclubs. The ground floor of the Pearl District buildings housed retail businesses, cafes, restaurants, and what looked like high-end clothing and home decorating stores. The upper floors, judging from what Tracy could see in the windows facing the street, were residential. Metal additions protruded from the roofs, likely multi-million-dollar penthouse condominiums.
"Busy area," she said, looking around the street. "A lot of people around."
The responding officers had set up a second perimeter at a wrought iron gate between two concrete pillars. The walkway led to a side entrance to the building.
"I'm looking for Detective Zhu," Kin said, again flashing his shield and ID.
"Third floor," the officer said.
"What unit?" Kins asked.
"Only one unit per floor. It's a loft."
At the end of the sloped concrete walk, they came to a glass door entrance beneath a forest green awning bearing the building's address and a symbol, what looked like an ampersand. Inside the lobby, with its wood plank floors and leather furniture, they walked across to an old-fashioned cage elevator and wide staircase.
"Let's take the stairs," Kin said. "Those things give me the heebie-jeebies."
"What about your hip?"
"I'd rather be in pain than die if that thing falls."
"God, you're paranoid."
"I like to think of it as pragmatic."
As they approached the staircase, Tracy noted three steps leading down to an exterior door. She took them and pushed on the door, which sprang open and led into a parking lot at the back of the building. She exited the building and let the door close behind her. When she tried the handle, she found the door locked and noticed on the wall beside it a keyless pad. She considered the light stanchions and corners of the surrounding buildings, but did not see any surveillance cameras. Retrofitted metal decks anchored by extension arms and large bolts protruded from the second and third stories and likely obstructed the tenants' views of the parking lot and anyone approaching the ground-level door. Kins opened the door for her from the inside, and they made their way up the staircase to the third-floor landing. They encountered the final perimeter, an officer with a clipboard and sign-in log just outside the loft door. Kins signed for both of them and again asked for Zhu. "Hang on," the officer said. He took a step inside the loft.
"Detective Zhu, you got a couple of visitors."
Tracy contemplated the door to the loft. Larger than a standard door, it looked solid, with metal rivets. She again noted a keyless lock pad. Neither the door nor the door jamb evidenced any sign of a forced entry. An Asian man with young features stepped into the hall. Kins and Jonathan Zhu shook hands, and Kins introduced Tracy.
"Well, this is one way to search an apartment," Zhu said. "What time did you talk to this guy today?"
Right around noon, Kin said.
Where did you meet him?
We interrupted him at some place called the Third Degree.
3 degrees? Zhu said. Down on the water?
Yeah, that's the one, Kin said. He was meeting someone for lunch.
A woman?
Yeah, Kin said.
Did she show?
Briefly, Kin said.
You get a good look at her?
Hard to miss. Tall, Asian, good-looking.
Come on in.
Zhu led them inside the loft. The interior consisted of an open floor plan interrupted only by thick, hand-hewn wooden beams extending to triangular trusses that supported a 20-foot ceiling. To the left of the entry, Tracy noticed a bench where people could sit and remove their shoes. Above it hung coats and jackets from metal hooks. One coat looked like the coat worn by the Asian woman at the restaurant. Tracy and Kins followed Zhu into a living area of leather couches, a glass coffee table, and a flat-screen TV. The early evening sunlight streamed into the room through arched windows. In the far corner was a kitchen. Metal steps led up to the second-story landing. They ascended. Partitions shielded their view as they approached a room where most of the activity was centered. Stepping around the partition, Tracy encountered a team of people from the medical examiner's office, hovering over and working around a blood-soaked bed, the white sheets and bedding stained a deep crimson red.
"Is she the woman you saw him with this afternoon?" Zhu asked.
They stepped from the loft back into the hall. Streaks of light through one of the arched windows cut slash marks across the floor. The noises of the Pearl District filtered up from the street, cars and the sounds of a city. The scene inside the loft was gruesome. A young woman lay face down on the bed, sheet lowered to reveal her bare shoulders and back, dark hair and blood forming a halo around her head.
"Who is she?" Tracy asked. "According to her driver's license, she's Megan Chen," Zhu said. 24 years old. Shares an apartment in inner northeast Portland with 2 roommates.
"Who found her? Who called it in?" Kins asked.
"Cleaning lady," Zhu said. "She's pretty shaken up. We have one of our female detectives talking with her at the station."
"Any estimate on the time of death?" Tracy asked.
"ME says a couple hours at most."
"Sufficient time for Strickland to leave the restaurant and get home," Tracy thought.
"They find a weapon?"
Zhu nodded.
9 millimeter.
"Likely the same caliber weapon used to kill Devin Chambers." Kin shifted his feet, the way he did when he was upset or frustrated.
"Any word on Strickland's whereabouts?"
"We sent a couple of detectives over to the law firm where he works. His assistant said he had a 3 o'clock appointment this afternoon but didn't show."
"That was with me," Tracy said. "I called yesterday to find out if he was around so we wouldn't make an unnecessary trip."
"The assistant tried his cell, but it went straight to voicemail," Zhu said. "Apparently he doesn't keep a home phone."
"You tracking his cell?" Kins asked.
"Trying," Zhu said. "He's had it shut off. We're also working on getting a warrant to track his credit cards and ATM in real time."
Zhu's cell phone rang. "This could be the judge." He stepped to the side to take the call.
"It doesn't make sense," Tracy said.
"What?"
Kins asked.
"Why someone who we think went to such effort to plan the deaths and disappearance of 2 women would shoot a third and leave her in his own bed?"
"Nothing in this case has made sense," Kins said. Zhu lowered his cell and looked at Tracy.
"Graham Strickland's attorney called the station. He said Strickland called him 20 minutes ago sounding distraught about a dead woman in his loft and someone trying to ruin his life. He's willing to turn himself in."
"That's good news," Tracy said.
"Yeah, but he wants to talk to you first."
Chapter 29 Zhu wasn't happy about conceding to Graham Strickland's request to speak to Tracy before turning himself in. To Zhu, Strickland was a suspect in a brutal murder, and if Zhu had had his way, he would have stormed Phil Montgomery's office with a SWAT team,
slapped handcuffs on Strickland, and hauled his ass downtown to an interrogation room in the police bureau. Tracy didn't feel like placating Strickland